Hi, everyone. Today we're speaking to Jessa and Nick from the legal podcast Getting Off. In the trial of Keith Montgomery, a plea was reached during deliberations. I want to ask you, how often do your cases result in plea deals, and how do you feel about them in general as a part of our criminal justice process? Because I know I've heard conflicting things about the way people view plea bargaining in the States. I know America is sometimes criticized by other countries who think the plea bargaining process that we're so reliant upon is coercive. So I was just interested, general terms, how you guys feel about them.
Yeah, which part of that should we handle first?
I think nationwide, over 95% of criminal cases resolve with a plea.
Yeah, I mean, if the question is how often do your cases result in plea deals, the answer is the overwhelming majority of the time. I mean, and that's true for essentially any lawyer.
In America, for sure.
In America, right. Even for lawyers who try a lot of cases, which I think that would be an accurate description of this law firm.
Yes.
I mean, still, over 90% of our cases resolve with plea deals.
Yeah, and most lower-level offenses resolve with plea deals because people, if they have privately retained counsel, it's sometimes not worth the financial cost when they can just plead guilty to, like, a disorderly conduct.
Yeah. That sort of leads into one thing that I didn't think about very much as a prosecutor, and I think about a whole lot more now, and I try to talk to prosecutors about sometimes, is when you've got somebody who's charged with something, even if there are potentially legitimate defenses, sometimes is the case that a defendant doesn't want to take their case to trial because trial is expensive.
Yeah.
Sometimes just the cost alone, you know, it's like, well, you know, the case could be resolved in such and such a way that may not be completely unpalatable, you know, maybe tolerable to a client, whereas, you know, taking the case to trial, which we might have a solid chance at an acquittal, meaning there are like seriously legitimate defenses, that is still going to be a very expensive proposition to engage in. And I don't think prosecutors think about that. And I try to encourage them to think about that in cases that are sort of borderline cases.
Well, and, you know, I'll say a couple of things. Number one, if every criminal defendant in America was like, fuck plea deals, I'm having a trial, the justice system would collapse. It is not built, like, our system is not built to have trials 100% of the time.
No.
Or even 50% of the time.
No, it's not. And that sort of goes to Chelsea's last question about, you know, is the plea bargaining system in America coercive compared to other countries? I think that question mostly references the federal system because federal prosecutors have a greater ability to act in a sort of coercive manner than state prosecutors do typically. Not exclusively, they have a greater ability. But it is, and there's federal decisions that talk about how the plea bargaining system is out of control in the federal system.
Right.
You know, I mean, federal judges have made that observation.
Well, because they are able to regularly threaten superseding indictments, which can greatly increase the penalty.
Right. And in the federal system, there are more things that have mandatory minimums than there are in your average state system. And so the prosecutor has an incredible amount of power, particularly in the federal system, because they can sometimes say, hey, look, if you don't do what I want you to do, I'll just charge you with something with a jacked up mandatory minimum. If you're willing to play ball with me, I'll charge it differently where there aren't mandatory minimums. You know, so a guy's still going to get whacked hard, but he's just going to get whacked less hard than if he says, look, I'm not rolling over. I'm not pleading. I'm going to go to trial. Then he faces losing on something with really significant mandatory minimum. Do I think that is coercive? Sure.
You know what else I think it's coercive is if somebody's unable to post their cash bail, mm-hmm. and the offer involves probation so they can get out of jail if they just enter the plea. That feels coercive to me.
Yeah. And what you just said, that the system has at least evolved to the point where there must be plea deals. And if everyone just, you know, rose up on their hind legs and said, I refuse to plea collectively, the whole system would explode.
And it would be a decade before trials were completed.
I'm going to reference a book here that I've referenced to you in the past. It's a book that's actually out of print. It's called One Just Man by a guy named James Mills. It was published, I think, in the 70s. It's out of print, but you can find copies of it. And it's an amazing book. Actually, it was given to me by a boss of mine when I was a prosecutor, and my prosecutor boss loved it. And it's about New York City, and it's about a guy who's a public defender basically in New York. And he becomes so frustrated with the cash bail system that basically incarcerates, you know, tons of people in advance of convictions. And the whole system is just, you know, it's just a machine of plea deals. And he sort of gets everybody to rise up and to refuse to plead and to demand trials. And it literally causes a revolution. The whole system explodes. And I guess I shouldn't spoil the end of the book, but it's an illustration of exactly what Jess is talking about. And the fact that it was written in the 70s illustrates that this is not a new phenomenon. It has been this way for decades. So, I mean, if we wanted to really afford everybody a meaningful opportunity to have their day in court and take their case to trial,
we need a lot more courts.
We would spend so much money. We would need to, you know, have so many more judges, so many more prosecutors, so many more courthouses. It just wouldn't work.
Yeah.
That's amazing. I mean, I wonder why the U.S. is so different than other countries in that regard. Like, why they don't face the same issues? Like, why we've come to be so reliant on the plea bargaining process and they haven't? Like, is it just that we have more crime here?
I honestly don't know the answer to that.
I think we do have more crime.
Sure.
And why if that's correct, the answer to why that would be correct is beyond mine.
That's outside of your pay grade.
But also, I think we have more criminal laws in this country. We
really do.
Prosecutors charge more things are charged as crimes in this country than in other places.
And right. The rate at which we criminalize things has increased steadily since the 1970s. Like, we have passed more and more and more laws criminalizing conduct, and so there's just a lot more criminal conduct.
That's really interesting. Yeah. that actually is starting to click and make sense for me. When things do get to trial, when these charges do make it all the trial, make it to a jury trial, and when deliberations begin, I'm curious, and I've been curious throughout the evolution of my season about the role of emotion, particularly when it comes to sensitive trials, but in all trials. I'm wondering, how much of a role do you think that emotion plays in the jury process, in that deliberations room? How big is that role?
Well, I mean, that's a great question, and that's part of the reason I think that Jess and I are such big fans of your podcast, is because it's hard to know, because no one's allowed back there, and that's a province that is sort of, you know, impenetrable unless a juror is willing to talk to you afterwards, and then you are just sort of getting one person's
right.
view, and you're, you know, it sort of reminds me of, like, you know, how when they try to do polls these days, they do it through a computer rather than with a person. Or sometimes when they do collect medical information, they like to do it in an automated fashion rather than with human beings, because people will be more honest with a computer than they will be with another human being who they think might be judging them. So I'm always wondering, like, all right, is this person giving me the straight dope, or are they sort of shading this in a way to make it slightly more palatable to me? You never know for sure.
Right.
But I suspect that it plays an enormous role.
I think it plays more of a role than it should. Mm-hmm. Except, you know what? I mean, if we're being honest, I play on jury's emotions just as much as I think the prosecution does. I mean, I think that's part of trial advocacy, is telling your version of the events persuasively and compellingly and emotionally.
I mean, there's no doubt that there are appeals to emotion on both sides. And that's not prohibited. I mean,
no.
Let's be clear about that. It has to be connected to fact of law. But you're allowed to make passionate emotional arguments that appeal to the same.
I mean, in fact, one of my trial prep techniques is to try and figure out what I identify as the dominant emotion in a case. Like, is this a self-defense case where fear is the dominant emotion? You know, is this a case where anger is the dominant emotion? Like, what is going on in this case, and how can we connect with that? And I mean, like, when you and I tried Steel, a ton of our prep was actually trying to figure out, how can we get the jury to buy in that they need to set the emotional aspects of this case aside, because that was such a science-heavy defense. You know, and we were both really nervous about that. That, like, on the one hand, you've got the, what were they good moms questions. And on the other hand, you've got some guy talking about, you know,
frontal
lobe injuries.
Right.
I mean, I think it plays a big role.
Yeah, I mean, it must. There's really no way around that. And it's interesting that you kind of need to identify which emotions are going to become more relevant in that trial. I think particularly with sensitive crimes, emotions must be higher than in other criminal trials, would be my guess.
I believe that. I absolutely believe that.
I struggle to think of any other.
Well, and I think that, I mean, a lot of this is just human nature, or at least we think it's human nature, right? Because, like, I think people are less likely to have an emotional reaction to a retail theft of whatever than they are to a human being testifying about having been terribly victimized by an alleged sexual assault. I mean, I think almost every human being is going to have a much stronger reaction to the latter.
Versus stealing running shoes from the mall.
Right.
All of my hypotheticals involve running shoes. What's up with that?
Yeah.
Okay. I'm giving the misimpression that I'm a runner or something, which I'm not.
You know, but also, maybe that was part of my reaction in season one, for example, to everybody's favorite bad guy, Carl, is that Carl wanted to talk about things like people's character, which... that's gussied up a little bit in, like, you know, something that's maybe sounds legal or sounds rational. But, like, to me, that's an appeal to emotion because you're trying to determine someone's guilt or innocence based on what you think of them as a human being.
Right.
Right. And that's, to me, that's an emotional and value laden assessment. It's not an assessment of facts or evidence.
I agree.
And I think, do I think people do that? I suspect people do it all the time.
Yeah, especially considering the process for jury. So, like, we're just choosing random citizens to come fulfill their civic duty rather than choosing, you know, legally minded professionals to sit in a box and just weigh the legal facts before them with that foundation of understanding.
Yeah. I also do think, though, that especially in sexual assault cases, and, you know, that's what we were comparing a moment ago, is it do people perhaps act with more of an emotional basis in sexual assaults and other kind of crimes? If you're talking about a sexual assault where there is an absence of physical evidence or corroborative evidence, then the jury is making a determination largely or perhaps entirely on their assessment of the witness's credibility, right. The credibility of the various witnesses. And so we don't have some kind of magical divining rod inside our bodies that allows us to know if what we're being told is true or not. And so that is at least partly an emotional evaluation process itself.
Yeah, because, you know, one of the things that I was so struck with in this season, Chelsea, is, you know, I have a tendency to find statement analysis interesting. I'm not sure that I find it to be bulletproof science by any stretch of the imagination. Mm-hmm. So I kind of was listening with a skeptical ear because I thought, you know, I thought I was going to struggle with it because I don't have faith that it is scientifically sound. But then as I was listening, I was like, you know, I just don't find this guy's statement credible, wholly independent of statement analysis and whether or not there are indicators of deception there or whatever. I just don't find this narrative credible because it's inconsistent with the things that he said before and the things that he said after.
And I don't need somebody breaking down the statement and on some other basis for me to find it not credible because it's inconsistent.
You know, and like, was that based on the fact that I think that Keith Montgomery is kind of a douchebag? I honestly don't think it is. I don't really care that I happen to think he's kind of a douchebag. You know, I mean, so for me, it's not because I dislike Keith that I found his statement not credible. I found his statement not credible because I put it in context.
Yeah.
Right.
But I mean, you're just talking about there, you know, and we talk a lot on our own podcast when we're breaking down trials about, I mean, we talk about what we think of the defendant sometimes,
right,
or their behavior, or their conduct. And sometimes we find it pretty fucking lagging.
Yeah. Sure.
So, but I mean, you and I do this for a living. So I don't think I would have a problem if I were on a jury being like, I think this guy's a complete prick,
but
separating that from evidence suggesting he's guilty or evidence suggesting he's not guilty.
Yeah.
But I don't, I mean, but we sit around and do this all day. I don't know how other folks would handle that.
I agree with you. I think it's probably harder for other people than it is for somebody whose, like, specific job is to divorce the character question from the facts.
That's what I'm saying. Right.
Yeah, that makes sense to me. How do you guys manage unlikable defendants in your line of work? How much harder does that make your job?
So much harder.
A lot harder.
so much harder. Because, you know, look, like, you kind of take them as you find them, right?
Mm-hmm.
And, sorry, that was a long pause because I'm trying to think of, like,
it's okay.
a kind
take your time.
Way to say this. But, like, some of them, no matter how much you work with them, are just going to either creep a jury out or make a jury angry, or they're going to shoot themselves in the foot because they're going to say something that opens the door to negative character evidence. Or, you know, I mean, sometimes you can have defendants that maybe aren't necessarily unlikable, but they're just nervous Nellies. And so they babble on and you can't get them into the rhythm of a question and answer. Right. You know, I mean, there are a lot of things that are, that can be difficult about trying to prep testimony, and likability is a big one.
Likability is one thing, and someone might be likable for a variety of different reasons. They might be likable because they come across as genuine. They might be likable because they're a really good actor.
They might be likable because they're physically attractive.
They might, that, good point. They might be unlikable for all sorts of different reasons. And sometimes you can fix those things or sort of like work with those things. And sometimes you can't. I mean, sometimes clients are criminal thinkers and come across as such. And it's hard to present, you know, it's a real challenge to try to present them in some other way than that. So that those kind of considerations are significant considerations when the client is thinking about whether or not they want to testify or not.
And usually if I can avoid putting an unlikable client on the stand, I will.
Right. Yeah. Oh, yeah. I agree with that.
If they absolutely have to testify and I know they're unlikable, I'll typically voir dire on that and I'll talk about it in opening and I'll make it pretty clear that being a creep isn't a crime and that I don't expect you to like my client or identify with him or want to go get a beer with him or let him date your sister. But that none of that is what we're here talking about.
Yeah, I think the default position is usually that unless you need your client to testify, you don't have them testify. I think that's or the most common starting point. But whether or not you need them to, a lot goes into that, right? And then the question is, you know, where is that threshold based on how well you think your client would come across?
Well, and I do think, and certainly the jury in season two, much to my absolute frustration, keeps coming back to the fact that Keith ultimately decided not to testify.
Yeah.
And they keep saying, well, why isn't he getting up and defending himself? And I think that that's a really common thing. And that's something else that if I know a client's not going to testify, I spend a lot of time talking about in jury selection. You know, because I do think, particularly because we practice law in the Midwest, in like the land of the corn and the handshake and the golly, people here, like we're salt of the earth people.
Oh, shucks.
People here think, gosh, if I were accused of that, I would be screaming from the rooftops that I didn't do it. And I think that men in particular have that reaction to the idea of being falsely accused of sexual assault. I think that most men, if they hypothesize about being falsely accused of sexual assault, are like, hell yes, I'd testify. I'd testify all day. And because I think that that's a really natural internal conversation of like, well, I would defend myself, that juries, you know, they're always instructed not to hold it against the defendant. But it is something you worry about.
I think another way to come at that issue is to talk to voir dire and to talk a lot in opening and closing about the burden of proof.
Yeah.
Because that's really what we're talking about when we talk about the significance of a defendant testifying or not. I think we're implicating the burden of proof. And so certainly judges and prosecutors and courts of appeals put a lot of faith in juries following the instructions they're given. And part of what we're talking about right now is whether or not that's so, because every jury is instructed that they're not, you know, allowed to consider whether or not the defendant testified or not and determine their guilt. I guess I put a fair amount of faith in that, but that's, you know, leavened with a healthy dose of, you know, my own sense of human nature. So, but I think coming at it, really trying to talk to the jury and making sure to the extent you can that a jury is going to take their constitutional obligations and the burden of proof seriously is another way to address that issue.
I agree.
Yeah, maybe it's because I'm a big fan of legal representation, legal drama, legal entertainment in general. Like, I'm just a consumer of that kind of media, that I would not, my typical expectation in a trial is for a defendant not to take the stand. So,
well, I think that's the most common scenario.
Well, and if you think about it, despite the human tendency to want to hear from somebody, do you know who have the least to add to a conversation at a criminal trial?
I know what you're going to say. It's
innocent people. If you're innocent, you have no idea what happened. You weren't there.
You didn't do it.
You didn't do it.
So other than getting up and saying, I didn't do it, what else do they have to add?
Right. And by having a trial, you have pleaded not guilty. So you've already said, I didn't do it.
Well, and not only is that implicit, but the court makes it explicit. I mean, the court informs the jury to this charge, the defendant is pleaded not guilty.
Right. Which means he's saying, I didn't do it. You know, and so there's really, other than kind of emotional value, there's not a lot of testimonial evidentiary value in having an innocent defendant testify. And I would suggest that there's probably even less value in having a guilty defendant testify.
You guys remind me so much of Deirdre in Serial season one right now, because when she was talking about weighing the credibility or just like garnering evidence from her, the client she speaks to for the Innocence Project, she's like, as soon as I realize that I have an innocent party on my hands, I'm like, oh, okay, so bye. I'll circle back with you in a few months when I've solved this case, because you're of no help to me. I'm going to stop talking to you.
Right. Like, what can they do for me? They can't do anything. You know, now, in sexual assault cases, when consent is the defense, I think it's very difficult to tell a credible consent narrative without the defendant providing that narrative.
Right.
So, I mean, if you're saying, no, the sex was consensual, I think it's hard.
Right, that's a totally different, because then, you know, you're saying the client was most certainly there.
Right, yeah. He was definitely there, and he agrees that the sex happened. He just doesn't agree about whether or not it was, forcible.
Yes.
That's a situation, and that would be this trial. Like, if Keith Montgomery really wanted to tell a narrative of consent, I think his statement sort of did that, because he says, I thought we had a nice time. But then he leaves that note on her car, and, he does things, his after-the-fact conduct kind of contradict that very brief statement he gave to the police, which basically yada-yada'd over the sexual activity. It was like, she was coming on to me, she wanted it, yada-yada-yada. I thought we had a nice time.
Right.
That's my summary of that. I don't know that I would have felt comfortable as defense counsel resting on that statement as the only time that jury got to hear a consent narrative. I think I would have wanted to be able to put my client up. And Keith had some problems.
Yeah.
There are reasons not to put Keith on that stand.
There were, definitely.
Yeah. Just out of curiosity, have you, and it's okay if you are not able to answer this questions. But have you ever had a client come to you and say, I'm being accused of this crime, I was blackout drunk, I have no recollection of what happened whatsoever?
Yes.
That must be difficult.
It's very difficult. And you got to do a lot to try and recreate a timeline using things like their cell phone, their social media. If they were at a party, you have to get all of the social media of anyone attended the party and try and look at that and just reconstruct what might have happened with independent sources. And sometimes you just can't.
Security camera footage exists sometimes, either from the street or building lobbies or that kind of stuff.
Right. Oh, that sounds like a heavy investigative mode. Yeah.
Because what's really also not helpful? I don't remember it all, but that doesn't seem like something I would do. Like, that's a pretty useless and self-serving statement.
Right. Yeah, that doesn't sound easy to navigate.
Yeah. It's trying to reconstruct from third-party sources, particularly with sensitive crimes, because they're almost never witnesses. Like, you can get a lot of information about what happened immediately before an alleged assault. You can get a fair amount of information about, what people saw after the alleged assault. But really, most of the time, the alleged assault happens, between two people with nobody else watching.
Right.
Yeah, I think something else you need to handle sometimes is calling, medical experts to talk about blackouts, because I think people struggle with accepting that.
Yeah.
I think sometimes there is, people struggle with the credibility of an assertion was, I don't remember. You know, in part, maybe that's human nature.
Oh, that's
too.
Convenient, is the response, right?
Yeah, exactly. That's convenient. And it's also pretty dissatisfying then to be in a position of a fact finder and having a witness tell you, I can't tell you what happened because I was blackout drunk.
Right. Hard to say. But trust me, I seem like a good guy.
Right. Yeah. I mean, we've also had cases where people have been charged with a form of sexual assault. You know, whereby the complainant, the idea is the complainant was so intoxicated that they were, from a legal perspective, unable to consent. And at least in Wisconsin, the statute concerning that, one of the elements is that the defendant had to have been aware of that. They had to have realized that the person was in that state. And so sometimes we have to wrestle with that side of it is, you know, there's the people in the role of the prosecution are suggesting that the victim was blacked out. And then there's all sorts of testimony about that. And that's actually a really, you know, blackouts or brownouts are actually a really complicated topic for, I mean, some of the reasons that I think we're making clear here. There's real problems with memory and what people are able to provide or not. But it's also a real problem because people, you know, and certainly in our understanding of the medicine and the toxicology behind this, people can appear to be okay, but in fact be in a state where they're not recording any memory.
Right. And that can present with a lot of problems because an outside observer might see the person walking and talking and ordering drinks and calling a cab and
seeming coherent. Yeah.
Yeah. Think that they're okay, but they are going to wake up the next morning with no recollection of how they got home.
Yeah. Yep. I know that's true. So, but I can also understand how a person who's never experienced that would grapple to believe it.
Right.
But I think what you said before is totally on point. And I think that's a reaction a lot of people have, like, wow, that's awfully convenient that in this particular, you know, circumstance where it's really fraught with danger for the defendant, like, oh, suddenly people can't remember things.
Right.
And they're coming up with some reason why they can't remember.
They can remember all of the irrelevant things, but they can't remember the important things. Right.
Right.
Yeah, you do run that risk.
Yeah, basically, I think in considering what I've learned from this season, because I really did strive to make it an even debate. I really wanted people to feel conflicted about whether or not they were moved enough to convict this person. And that isn't the way the trial turned out. For anyone who's not clear about the way that my show is formatted, it's the jury deliberations are entirely improvised. So I really don't have any control over the way they discuss or how they feel or the way their opinions are shaped. So what I've learned is that when it comes down to matters of he said, she said, it comes down to, a lot of times, trust and consistency. Like, if the jury trusts one person over another, that's going to be the turning point. If they find one person, and consistency plays into that. If they find one person, you know, to have been more consistent in their statements and in their behavior, then that's going to lean them toward trusting that party.
Yeah, I accept that as true, particularly, especially so in the context of a one accuser trial.
Yes.
Right. I think the dynamic changes if you have multiple accusers. But I mean, of course, that's what we're talking about. I think in particular here is season two of deliberations. And I totally accept that as true. I mean, because those are really, I think what we're talking about are sort of the building blocks of credibility.
Right.
Consistency and trust.
Yeah.
You know, how is it that we go about deciding whether or not we believe somebody? And I think those are two of the key variables.
And, you know, what I will say is, and obviously you and I consulted about this season and we talked about, you know, I had a sneak peek as to what the evidence was going to be. The way that it went in versus the way that we talked about it, I think was different. Because when you and I would have conversations about it, I thought you were hitting a pretty good even debate point in terms of the scripted portions of it. But, you know, I mean, as I sit here, not that anyone's asked me, but I'm going to tell you anyway, because that's how I roll.
Please do.
I would have convicted him.
Right.
And number one, anyone that listens to our podcast knows that it's very difficult to get me to convict anybody because I've got defense attorney bias up the wazoo.
You would have convicted Casey Anthony.
I would have convicted Casey Anthony, but I would have acquitted Scott Peters.
Right.
So, but given that, you know, here's where I come down with it. Number one, Riley was what I would describe as relatively sober. She had three drinks over the course of a few hours. She would have been legally able to drive. I don't think that her recollection is going to be visibly and notably impaired by alcohol. In contrast, Keith shows up and, yeah, there's not really any testimony to contradict that he was hammered when he showed up. He's sending pretty gross text messages about what his intentions are. Now, some of that is bravado, but I also think it does speak to the fact that he wanted to go get laid.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, that doesn't necessarily translate into planning on sexually assaulting somebody hours in advance. But, like, I think he was being pretty straight with his, you know, with Bromeo there on what he was going to go do. And then, you know, after the fact, he leaves this note on the car that Riley's testimony completely contradicts what his purported reason for that would be. Because he says, oh, yeah, I just didn't want Lila to find out. Well, it sounds like from everyone else that had anything to do with this case, it was clear that Lila was over. So I don't buy that as a credible reason for leaving that note. So, you know, to me, Riley testified consistently. I think the defense in their opening really oversold their proof that she was obsessed with him, or
that was overplayed.
Yeah, I mean, and that wasn't like defense counsel oversold that, but that's not when Riley actually took the stand. It didn't come off like that at all.
Right.
And I get why defense counsel, you know, like, look, you need to tell a narrative to explain how you think things came to be the way they are. You can't just like completely throw your hands up in the air, even though it's not our burden to prove. It's still our job to put on a coherent theory of defense, whether that's you just can't meet your burden or this didn't happen or whatever. And so I understand the tendency to, you know, to come out swinging and opening, but I don't think they proved that up, and that hurt their credibility with me.
Well, you can't overplay your hand. I mean, you right. can't turn facts into something they're not. And you risk your own credibility and the credibility of the client as a result of the credibility of the entire defense if you do that. And right. I agree with it. I thought they overplayed it.
Yeah.
Have you ever felt like, or do you feel like in general juries will hold it against attorneys if they don't address everything they did in their opening, or they don't prove everything they said they were going to prove in their opening? Because I remember that being a real talking point about the Casey Anthony trial, and not to bring everything back to that, but Jose Baez made a lot of claims in his opening statement that wound up not being proved during trial, and everyone thought the jury was going to hold that against him. Somehow they didn't.
I don't think you want to do that, because I think Jessa and I both place a big
premium on credibility.
On our credibility, right? And because I think we both think that juries will move toward the advocate who they find more credible.
Yes.
And what stems from that is we try to focus on finding true things that we can say. I'm not interested in saying things to a jury that are not true. I'm not interested in lying to a jury. I want to find true facts that I can emphasize to a jury, and, you know, truths about the case that I can direct the jury's attention to. That said, even if a jury finds the lawyer completely full of shit, that, you know, the facts are the facts. And the jury may simply, I mean, I perhaps what happened in the Casey Anthony trial is that the jury, despite Jose Baez, found the state couldn't prove their case.
Well, and in my experience, and you and I have talked about this, there is a phenomenon that exists that when the defense attorney is just a doofus, sometimes juries straight up feel bad for the defendant.
I certainly wonder if they do. Yeah.
And give maybe a little more benefit of the doubt than, you know, I mean, that's actually feedback that I've heard from juries before, is that it was so obvious, not to toot my own horn here, but that, you know, the state was just so badly out-lawyered that the jury found that they were trying to make arguments on behalf of the state because the state just hadn't done a particularly persuasive job making arguments.
They were trying to make up for the deficient performance of the attorneys. Right. And I mean, we've had cases where, you know, we find out that jurors after the fact wrote letters to the judge about the lawyers on their side, saying, you know, that person ought to be fired.
Saying, I really wanted to convict this guy, but I had to let him go because the state was just so bad at doing what they were supposed to do.
Right.
I mean, that, like, and that's happened to, like, our office has seen things like that. You know, and so I do think that depending on how bad it gets, the jury sometimes might overcorrect.
Right, and
For either side.
But what is important to remember here is it depends on the case. There are some cases where the evidence is such that the verdict's going to go, you know, at least in retrospect, the verdict's going to go, was going to go one way.
Like your escape trial.
Correct. I guess what I'm saying here is there are trials where the lawyering makes all the difference, and there are trials where the lawyering may have made almost no difference. And that can go in a few different directions, one of which Jess had just described. The jury might try to, you know, compensate for the performances of one of the attorneys. So I really think you've got to look at it on a sort of case-by-case, trial-by-trial basis. And it depends. It's very fact-specific. The public perception seemed to be, in Casey Anthony, that Jose Baez was kind of a boob and was stumbling his way through that trial, but he still won. Was the jury trying to make up for his deficient performance? Was the state's case just sufficiently weak to the jurors who actually sat there and listened to all the admissible evidence? I don't know the answer to that question.
Right. And the only insight we have into that jury room is what people choose to say after the fact, which I've actually read up about some juror accounts post unfavorable verdicts being delivered, and a lot of them tended to say, well, that wasn't the way I wanted to go, but, you know, everyone else kind of made
right.
But yet everyone in the room is saying that. So it's like, well, that feels unlikely. I mean, you can say whatever you want when you come out of that room.
Exactly.
Right.
Right.
Which is actually, I mean, it's designed to be that way.
Right. And it should be because you shouldn't have to answer questions if you don't want to. Like their job is done when they leave that room.
Well, and it's along the lines of, you know, federal judges getting lifetime appointments. It's like we want these people to be secure, you know, have sufficient security to make the decisions that they think are legally correct, regardless of how popular or unpopular that decision may be.
Right.
Right.
Now, they might make that decision then in the relative privacy or sanctity of the jury room. And this sort of goes to what I was talking about before. And then they may come out and choose to talk to other people about it and describe it differently because they are worried about the perception of others. But that, I mean, that's just a stronger argument for keeping the jury room
sealed. Right.
Yeah,
that does make sense. Before I ask you to promote Getting Off and to talk about how listeners can find out more about it, were there any more closing thoughts you guys wanted to address in terms of the season or sensitive crimes in general or the jury process, anything at all?
Well, I want to critique your defense attorney.
That's okay.
Number one, she oversold her opening.
Right.
Number two, you asked earlier in this interview about likability. And one thing that the jurors kept saying over and over again was that they thought her tone was condescending and hostile. I think I can fix that for her. And I think she did two things that were she to have adjustments in her trial advocacy skills would make that a lot better. Number one, she kept apologizing to Riley, but it didn't seem very genuine. And I'm of the firm belief that the sort of mumble room, I know this must be difficult for you, is kind of a bullshit move to play as the defense attorney.
Well, I think you use that only, I shouldn't use that word. You ask questions like that only if the person is giving answers that may actually be helpful to you in their lack of response. You're like, all right, what's going on here? Like, you actually don't want to be here, do you?
Right.
This is hard for you, right? If you can suggest that part of the reason it's hard for them is because the information they're giving isn't credible.
Sure. But
if you're trying to play to sympathy as the defense attorney,
like, don't apologize when you don't care.
I think you can try to depict yourself as a reasonable, sensitive human being. It's another thing to apologize.
Well, like, here's a situation where an apology might be appropriate. You're trying a homicide, and it's an eyewitness ID case. And the bereaved spouse of the deceased takes the witness stand solely for the purpose of IDing the body. They weren't at the crime scene. They're not making an eyewitness ID. They're only being called because they're, you know, they have the unfortunate reality of having to ID their dead spouse. That's a person that I would apologize to. Now, I probably would not cross-examine that person. I would probably have no questions for a witness on that fact pattern.
Right. What is there to dispute?
Right. You know, so like that I think would be fine and it would be genuine. But if your theory of the case is that this girl is mentally unstable, which was like one of the threads, one of my least favorite defense threads, and obsessed with this guy and was making this accusation, you know, because he rejected her after the fact, then you wouldn't be, if you believed that was true, you wouldn't be apologizing to this woman.
Right.
You know, so like that's really, to me, that makes the defense attorney lose credibility. The other thing was that defense attorney asked three too many questions on every topic.
The defense attorney.
Yeah, because she, you know, she kept asking Riley, well, don't you think your laughter could be construed as flirtatious?
No, of course
Riley's going to say no. You just, your good fact is she has to concede that she laughed at one point. So you just say, there was a point where he had his arms on you and you laughed.
Correct.
Yes.
And then you move on.
Right. And then you argue in close he understood that to be consensual.
Everything else is the proverbial bridge too far.
Right.
Because they're not going to admit.
No!
They're not going to admit to the view of the facts that you want the jury to believe. All of that's for argument. So you just get the facts that you can use later in argument and you stop there.
And also, it's way more comfortable and more acceptable to the jury that's watching for you to go through in closing and say, I want to talk to you about all of the ways that Riley Page showed affirmative consent to Keith Montgomery. She invited him in. She knew he was drunk. She poured him multiple drinks. She felt safe drinking with him alone. He had never harmed her before. There was no reason to suggest that. They goofed around. They have this history of being playful or playfully aggressive or whatever the phrase was. At one point, he has his arms on her and she laughed. You know, you paint that picture in the closing argument. You don't try and get your complaining witness to agree to it. Because, of course, what is she on the witness stand? Going to be like, you're right, I made it all up.
Well, that's, what are you playing? Are you playing for like a Perry Mason moment?
Right.
It doesn't happen.
You know, so like, and that's actually something that I think lawyers with less trial experience, and I know that this was written that, you know, he had a public defender. I got the sense that people had some critiques of her caseload and things, and that was all kind of incorporated into this season, so it makes sense to me that she would do that. But, like, as I was listening to her cross, I was like, oh, girl, we need to tighten this up. We need... What are you doing? Stop asking questions. So that, you know.
That is... That's really funny. It's also interesting the fact that she apologized. I see now clearly how that really did undermine her own defendant in a way that I didn't appreciate before. So, yeah.
You know, because like maybe her defense, maybe the better defense here would have been. And honestly, I do think this was a pretty strong case for the state. You know, the vaginal tearing or the perineum tearing of That could go either way, but the text before, the note after, with the tearing, with her being credible on the witness stand, I mean, that, plus Keith's got a criminal history, so he couldn't testify. I mean, the state's got a pretty strong case there. I think that they do. I think that her better defense would have probably been to suggest that Riley's intoxication led her to either do something that she later regretted or led her to engage in behavior that she isn't 100% clearly recalling. I think she's obsessed with him and had this vengeance. That's, to me, if you're going to call a woman who is testifying about being sexually assaulted a flat-out liar, I think you got to be able to prove that. Even though it's not our burden, I think if you're going to call them a liar, you need to be able to bring some type of affirmative evidence in to support the idea that they lie.
If you're just going to sit there and call her names, like calling her a liar without proof, I would call that just calling names.
Yeah.
That's not, I would be highly skeptical that that's going to go anywhere.
No, like maybe.
Other than to make you disliked by the jury.
Yeah. Like maybe 50 years ago, it was fine to get up and.
Right.
call an alleged victim a whore or call her crazy, but I just don't think we do that anymore. I mean, I certainly don't think that's a persuasive defense. That's not a defense I'll put on. Unless, of course, I have documented mental health history that supports the idea that there's a pattern of false accusations, then we're in a different arena. But in this case, there was just no evidence of that.
Right. Yeah, the whole thing turned out a little more. I mean, I was surprised last season, by the way it turned out. I was a little surprised at the speed and ease with which this conviction happened. But either way. Plus, I have to say this. Ashley Fain is the name of the woman who played the complaining witness, Riley Page. And she was such a powerful actress. And I didn't anticipate that type of passion given as a performance in this testimony. Like when I was writing it, it came out completely differently in my head. And when she was in the room, here in my apartment, in the room I'm in right now, delivering this testimony, I was moved. And
right.
I started feeling emotional about her. And there were other people in the room who kind of like missed it up. And there were actually some portions that I took out of episode 11 because she just like cried a little more. And I was like, oh my God, this is heart wrenching. Like it's so it's hard to account with writing before I cast. But she wound up being such a powerful witness that I think I think anyone would be hard pressed to find a jury that could listen to testimony like that, that could like feel that compelling. And
yeah, I mean, I found it very credible.
Yeah.
Likewise. And I think that's something that defense attorneys and prosecutors really need to be aware of is if you have a sexual assault case and there is not an audio or video recording of whatever the account that's being given by the complaining witness, if you're just reading it cold on a piece of paper in a police report, you need to think about it quite differently than how it just looks on paper. You need to think about what that's going to look like in a dead serious proceeding in a courtroom in front of a jury with a live human being talking about being victimized.
Well, do you remember?
Because that presentation can, I mean, Chelsea, I really like the way you just described it. I mean, you wrote this. And when you then saw your own words, you know, come out of a live human being's mouth, it was incredibly powerful.
Yeah.
With a talented actress. And when that happens in real life, I think oftentimes that is an accurate representation of what happens in a courtroom is when you have a hurt human being, a real live breathing human being that other human beings will feel sympathy and empathy for, that is very powerful.
Well, and like, remember that case we did in Adams County in 2014? It was a multi-accuser trial. It was like, lots. Okay. It was
many.
Yeah. Between the other acts, witnesses, and the actual charged victims. And I can use the word victim because this client was convicted. There were almost a dozen people that testified about sexual misconduct of various types. And there was one that when we read the police reports, we were like, whatever, this one's easy. Like, and then she testified, like, was like the most credible witness that we had, you know, out of the whole group where, I remember turning to you at the end of her direct and going, so that absolutely happened.
Yeah, we both, that was our reaction. That happened.
Like, you know.
And that was the one that we thought was the least credible on paper.
Right. We were totally not prepared for the way that she presented on the witness stand based on reading the reports. Like, we were sure she was going to be a weak witness and she was awesome.
We sat there and watched her testimony. We're like, well, we're losing that one.
Yeah, and then some of the ones that we were pretty worried about really weren't that credible.
Right.
Comparative, you know what I mean? So it's the difference between a cold record and a live read is
significant.
Yeah.
God, that's amazing.
We both just said that happened. Like, yep.
Not much you can do at that point.
Well, no. Like, it is what it is.
You guys, thank you so much for taking the time and sharing your expertise about all of this. I, as always, find it invaluable. And I love listening to Getting Off and continuing to learn from that. And the way you tackle sometimes unfavorable opinions in a way that's completely irreproachable. Like, you know, you have an amazing way to deliver information that is palatable to everyone. Can you tell us about Getting Off and what it is and how we can find more of it?
Absolutely. So our podcast is called Getting Off with Jessup and Nick. You can find it wherever you consume and obtain podcasts. And you can also connect with us. You can email us at gettingoffpod@gmail.com. You can, we would totally encourage people not only to listen to the podcast, but we've got, as you do as well, Chelsea, your Facebook discussion group, which both of us are members of, has really lively, thoughtful, nuanced, sensitive, intelligent dialogues. And I like to think that our Facebook group does as well. So we really encourage people to join our group and join the discussion. Certainly you can reach us at Instagram and Twitter, also at Getting Off Pod. Yeah, so our podcast, Getting Off, is largely about criminal trials. And Jess and I think probably everybody listening knows that we are criminal defense attorneys and we are trial attorneys. So we try to bring to a discussion of, you know, true crime, specifically the perspective of trial attorneys. And we talk about legal issues in noteworthy trials. And we talk about the motion work, the way the trials actually went down, and try to offer a specifically legal perspective to those things. Separately, we also do episodes on what we think of as more policy-based matters, criminal justice reform, bail reform. We're going to be doing an episode in the near future about the relatively newly elected district attorney in Philadelphia who is causing a lot of upset because he was elected as a reformer and
He is reforming.
He is walking the walk. So we tackle sort of like larger issues within the criminal justice sphere as well. And I think we do so in a way that is both serious and darkly humored.
Yeah. And I think some of them are funnier than others. I think some of them are pretty serious and some of them we make a lot of inappropriate jokes. I was going to say on the subject of our podcast, one topic that we covered in today's interview is the potentially coercive nature of plea agreements. And if people want to hear more about that, I'd point them to our episodes on Kalief Browder, because that was something that came up while we were recording those episodes and talking about having a young man be in custody and being offered the opportunity to be released from custody if he pled guilty to something that he
said he didn't do. If only he would just plead guilty.
So if that's a topic that people are interested in hearing more about, I'd encourage them to check out those episodes.
Excellent. And before I let you go, can you tell me, each of you, which is your favorite episode of Getting Off? Or is that too hard?
I think the episodes that we did on Larry Nassar were well done. And,
good ones.
You know, from my, good ones from my perspective, pretty powerful. That's obviously a pretty intense and powerful situation. The Kalief Browder episodes were good. We do talk about the potentially coercive nature of plea bargains in that case. We also talk about an issue that is really near and dear to my heart, which is what I view as the abuse of the cash bail system. That is sort of one of really the bullet point issues in the Kalief Browder case. And the Kalief Browder case is incredibly tragic. I might direct people to those episodes, the Kalief Browder and Larry Nassar episodes.
It's funny because I just had someone text me yesterday and ask, hey, I'm going to start listening to your podcast. Do you have any recommendations? And the three sets that I said were Kalief Browder, Larry Nassar, and William Kennedy Smith, because I just thought we were funny in those two. I just had a lot of fun doing them. Like, yeah. I just liked the case.
Yeah.
So those were the ones that I had a lot of fun doing.
We started off doing Brock Turner, the Stanford.
Oh, yeah. Our first go was fun, too. You know, we have fun with it. Like, we have a lot of fun. So
that's the most important thing.
Yeah.
Well, thank you guys again so much for making the time, and I hope to be speaking with you again soon.
Sounds good. You know you can't get rid of us.
Oh, good. Thanks to Jessa. Thanks to Nick. Thanks to you for listening. I'll be online talking about season 3 as soon as it's concrete in my brain. Thanks again, and I'll meet you back here soon.